This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. From the beginning of her life, Riva Lehrer has been reading faces. Born with spina bifida, she spent her childhood in hospitals, enduring countless surgeries. And there, surrounded by doctors and nurses who were in charge of decisions about her body, she learned to read the truth in their faces, to brace for whatever was next. She became a teacher, a writer, and most notably an acclaimed painter. Her work focuses on portraits of those whose bodies, sexuality, and gender identity have been stigmatized by society, challenging what and who is seen as normal. But given her work, the pandemic and its social distancing and mask wearing, it's all presented challenges for her, both as a person with a disability and an artist. Joining us now from Chicago is Riva Lehrer. Her paintings hang in the National Portrait Gallery, at the Smithsonian, and in the Illinois State Museum in Springfield. She recently published an op-ed in the New York Times called "The Virus Has Stolen Your Face from Me," as well as a recent memoir called "Gollum Girl," which is on the Kirkus Review's Best Books of 2020 list. Riva Lehrer, thanks so much for being with us today on The 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to come back to the New York Times op-ed I mentioned, but first I want to talk about your recent book, Gollum Girl. In the beginning, you explore the etymology of the word monster and how it's related to your life. Can you talk about that?
Well, the etymology is based on two words, monstrare and monstrum, and they both have multiple meanings, but some of them have to do with an entity or an object that reveals a truth. And I thought a lot about that because when you think about what monsters do, they primarily violate boundaries. They combine categories, the living and the dead, the human and the animal, the human and the machine, and they make us confront our assumptions about what is acceptable and what is human. And for me, disability has very much been a category of monster in that every time disability gets added to a situation or a discourse, you find out what the people around you and the society around you really values. And certainly right now with what's going on with the pandemic and the fact that right from the beginning, disabled people were being told that their lives were less important, that they were less likely to receive life-saving medical care, even that it was possible in the beginning that people might have their respirators taken away. I don't know if that was true, but that was certainly something that people I knew were hearing. And so we went from a moment in early in the year when there was a huge amount of breakthrough in disability culture, all these TV shows and writers and books and, I mean, theater, films, they were just exploding. And I was feeling great. I thought, we're finally being seen in the way that we want to be seen. And then here came the pandemic. And in five hot minutes, we were told that, no, actually, you're not important to your society. We'd be fine if you just stayed in your room and never came out, or maybe quietly died, and all of us healthy 30-year-olds can go off and hit the bars. It was a very painful, doesn't cover it.
Yeah.
So I feel like being disabled and the way it connects me to the idea of the monster as one that just blows apart people's assumptions has been consistent through my life.
For people who may not be familiar with spina bifida, what is it like to live with that?
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of spina bifida, and all I can speak to is what it's like for me, because it affects people very differently, and it depends on where the lesion happens in the spine, how severe it is, what kind of surgical intervention you get. It's very multivalent. For me, it's meant a lot of surgery, a lot of hospitalization, looking and walking differently, I'm 4'9", and I wear very impressive orthopedic shoes that actually have names. The larger one is George, and the smaller one is Gracie, after George Burns and Gracie Allen. But but it's, you know, it gets me stared at. I think every aspect of my life has been impacted by people assuming what I couldn't do based on what they saw.
Can you talk about your journey then to becoming a painter and how your life and your experiences have led you into portraiture specifically, in which you explore and focus on human bodies and faces in particular?
Well, as I talk about in the book, I grew up for the first few years in the hospital. And I think, you know, looking back, when that happens, when you don't leave at all, and you don't have an experience of the outside world that other kids your age get, you focus on what's around you, especially anything that seems like it's going to be determinant of your immediate future. And so learning to read people, learning to read faces, I think was pretty crucial during those years. And so when I started art school, I come from a family with a lot of aesthetic talent in various directions. And when I started art school, it didn't take long for me to realize that portraiture was what really just stopped me in my tracks of, you know, all the things we were studying. And so in studying the history of portraiture, it got obvious really fast that there were no disabled people in any of the museums that I saw, in any of the classes I took, in any of the books that I read, unless they were just figure paintings, which are not portraits, meaning not about a specific important individual, but a scene that the artist has depicted for various reasons. So you could see lots of disabled people in religious paintings where they were like lepers and the blind and, you know, being healed by Jesus and his saints. And that was the only time that I would see a disabled person in a painting, pretty much. And so as much as I loved it, I always felt like I was locked out of, well, I was explicitly told by my professors and later my gallerists and curators and critics, and don't do that. Don't depict the disabled body. They're disgusting. And also, you'll never have a career. No one's going to want to show this. No one's going to want to buy it. Do something else. And I mostly did that. And then in 1995, I was incredibly lucky to meet this fantastic woman named Susan Nussbaum, who's a very well-known actress and novelist, playwright, activist. And she's not someone you say no to. So she invited me to this group called the Chicago Disabled Artists Collective, which I totally did not want to go to. It sounded depressing to me. I had really avoided other disabled people because all I heard was that it's awful to be disabled and you should be ashamed and don't be that and hide that. And, you know, so I had really tried. And Susan said, you need to come to this meeting. I'm not letting you get out of this. So I found myself at this meeting, and this meeting was full of some of the founders of disability culture in America, which I didn't know at the time. But they were hilarious and they were funny and they were not interested in pity or hiding or apologizing, or, you know, the work was really sharp. And I just fell in love. And I was sitting there one day at one of our meetings and looking around the table, and I realized that not only was everyone fascinating to look at, that everybody reminded me in a different way of a Northern Renaissance painting. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to try and paint people, not as if they're from the Northern Renaissance, but with that kind of seriousness. And unfortunately, I didn't really have the skills. It was all aspirational. But that started, it actually started in 97. And so I've been trying to work not just with disability, but with the idea of stigma, the various things that get you stigmatized in the world, including gender and sexuality and race. And I let my collaborators come to me and tell me. I don't walk up to someone and say, you must be stigmatized. Right. You're gonna sit for me. But yeah, I've worked with just the most remarkable people.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you to our listeners. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Chicago-based artist and writer Riva Lehrer. She's an acclaimed painter. Her recent memoir is called Gollum Girl. And she recently had an op-ed in the New York Times about being a portrait artist during the pandemic called The Virus Has Stolen Your Face From Me. And I want to ask you about that because you say, you write, masks are both saving my life and ruining it. And you've talked about the idea of your subjects or partners, as you call them, being the visibility of them is crucial to you. Can you talk about that process for you and how the pandemic has affected that?
Well, you know, first off, this is my career. And I, right now, I cannot have anyone in my studio. And that's been true since March, and it's been heartbreaking. You have to understand that when someone comes to sit for me, they're not just sort of plunked like a piece of furniture in the corner. We're having like incredibly profound conversations and thinking together. And I mean, it's those conversations that have really changed me and saved my life. And now that can't happen. Certainly not in the way it did. And then also I teach anatomy. And so I've spent years trying to understand the mechanics of the face and its evolution. And I'm just passionate about it. So now I go outside and I have a mask on. Actually, I have two on. I wear a surgical mask taped to my face to try and limit leakage around the corners because I have pre-existing conditions. And if I get this, it doesn't look good. So I wear a surgical mask and with tape, and then I have a cloth mask over that. And as I'm walking around, two things are happening. One is that I can't people watch anymore. I can't think about faces. I think I always had kind of a stream of consciousness of face when I was out, just sort of registering them, thinking about them subconsciously, taking memories of them home. But the other thing is, because I am visibly disabled and walk with a limp and have a curved spine, I've always used my face to kind of manage people's reactions to me. So, you know, trying to beam something like, I'm present. I'm here. I mean, disabled people get treated all the time like they're, if you're with somebody else, the stranger will talk to your companion instead of you, as if you are incapacitated. And also, you know, talking to people, like getting them to see me the way I want to be seen. So now I have this mask on and none of that is possible. And now I'm just getting sort of reactions to just my body. And I'll tell you a story. A couple of days ago, I fell in the park. I was out at the lake and I hit a patch of ice and I fell really hard. And I was about 5 feet from the running path. And four or five people passed me while I'm lying there on the ground and I'm yelling, help. And they're just going right past me. And I wondered later if I was scary looking to them or what. And finally, like fifth or sixth guy came by and I'm screaming at this point. And he peers at me and goes, oh, do you need something? I'm like, oh God, no, I just ice bathed for the pleasure of it.
Yeah.
And he got me up. But it really made me think about the fact that I couldn't use my face and they couldn't hear me talk, maybe.
Yeah.
And so I'm lying there on the ground and nobody's nobody's seeing me as a fellow human being.
And I'm afraid we have to end our conversation there. I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and some of your stories with us today, Reva Lehrer, on the 21st. That is all for today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.